Welcome once again to A Pain in the Glass podcast. This is Bill Shearheart, National Coach with Curling Canada, coming to you from Sydney, British Columbia, on the ancestral land of the Wasanek First Nation. A Pain in the Glass podcast is sponsored by Canada Curling Stone of Kamoka, Ontario. Today's episode is entitled Playing the Shots. I have selected four shots that, on balance, just my opinion, of course, I think are not played very well. They're probably a good strategy decision. I think it's the shot to play. But this episode is all about how you play those shots. And for those of you who have listened to all of the episodes, or many of the episodes in A Pain in the Glass podcast, if you go back to a podcast entitled Pebble Water 1.0, oh, and by the way, soon there will be Pebble Water 2.0, I talked about one of those shots, and I decided I would talk about it once again in connection with three others that I think are not played all that well. And before I go on to begin this episode, and something that perhaps I should have talked about before, when I choose the topics for episodes in A Pain in the Glass podcast, I think of my target audience being recreational competitive teams. Not all of the episodes are designed for that particular listening group, but most of them are. And I would hope that if you are on a team playing in a recreational league, you have no aspirations about playdowns, perhaps you don't go to very many competitive bonspiels or bonspiels at all, but you do want to be competitive in your league at your curling facility. But you do care about your performance. The wins and losses make a difference, and you do want to perform better. You are the people that I'm talking to most of the time. Well, with that said, let's talk about these four shots and how to play them. And I want to start with what I consider, and it's just a basic shot. We play it all the time. And the shot to which I'm referring is a guard. For those of you out there who say, well, Bill, you've talked about this shot before. Well, you're right. I have talked about it before, but I decided to include it in this collection anyway, because it bears repeating. There are two kinds of guards. There's a guard that is positioned all by itself. One rock, the guard, trying to guard one rock, very likely in the house, of course. That poses a very interesting problem because you have to use one rock basically to cover both paths into the target rock. And that's the first point I want to make about guards. You're really not guarding the rock, the target rock. You're guarding the path to the rock. Never forget that. I so often think we fall into the trap that, well, there's the rock, the target rock. That's the rock we want to protect. So we have to get a rock in front of it. Well, not exactly. You want to guard the path to the rock. The other kind of guard, which is much more common, is a guard that is placed in concert with rocks, guards, doesn't matter the color, that are already guarding one of the paths to the rock. So let's say, for example, that there is a rock in the house that is to be guarded. So there's the rock in the house, and up there guarding the counterclockwise path to the rock are two or three other rocks. So our task then is to place a guard to guard the clockwise path into the target rock. And so this is what happens so often, and it sounds perfectly sensible. The skip determines exactly the right place for the brush. The person delivering the rock tries to give the right weight, the exact right weight that's called for, probably in zone 3. Sounds like a great idea. And so you've got the skip with the brush in exactly the right place so that if the person delivers exactly the right weight, the rock will come to rest in exactly the right position, right? No, wrong. That is not how you play the shot. Sounds like it's the way to play the shot. Indeed, it is the way that most teams play the shot, but you know what happens most of the time? In the last 1, 2, or 3 feet of that guard's journey, it overcurls. And now instead of having 2 or 3 rocks guarding the counterclockwise path to the target rock, you now have 4. The way you play that shot is for the skip to position the brush, again, assuming the person's going to deliver the right weight. But here's the key. You position the brush so that if the player hits the brush, the rock has to be brushed into position. Let me repeat that. The rock has to be brushed into position. When you do that, you're going to be much more successful guarding that shot rock. If you actually leave an agonizingly small hole, which may or may not be big enough for a curling rock, you've done a much better job of guarding than if the rock, your guard, overcurls, and now you've given your opponent a path, an open path, and all they have to do is match it up with whatever weight is most comfortable, and your guard is absolutely useless. It's the most misplayed shot in curling. The other shot that I want to talk about is the bump tick. Now, as I am sending this to you on, what is it, April 27th here of 2022, there is a movement afoot by the World Curling Federation to play the centerline no tick rule. And that was what occurred at the WCF Men's and Women's Championship. But here, for my senior teams, no such rule is in place. Time for an interjection here on January the 24th, 2023. The WCF has indeed decided to use the no-tick rule during its events for this curling season. So when I take my senior teams in about a month and a half or so, a little bit more than that, to Seoul, South Korea, we will be playing the no-tick rule. But you may not have to deal with the no-tick rule in your league, at your curling facility, so I still want to talk about this shot. And so the opposition has, without last rock, they have positioned a rock on the center line quite close to the top of the house. And this is my favorite shot. You play the bump tick. I think it's a much better shot than drawing around, because in essence, that's exactly what the team without last rock wants you to do. I don't like to do things that the other team wants me to do. And here's how you play this shot. You play it from the shooter's perspective as though you are going to draw around it top 4 foot or button weight. The difference is the skip doesn't quite give you enough ice to do it. And if you deliver that top button, top 4 foot weight, and the skip hasn't given you enough ice to make it around, you tick that rock, that opposition rock that's tight to the top of the house, you tick it on the corner, you push it into the house. Now, of course, it's vulnerable to be taken out, and your rock rolls into a corner guard position. I can make the case that you've made 3 shots. You've opened up the path to the 4 foot, you've placed an opposition rock in the house, and you've positioned a corner guard because, of course, with last rock, you want to play to the side of the sheet. It is a great shot. I don't know why it isn't used more often. Plus, if you are successful executing the bump tick, it's a sign to the opposition that maybe they shouldn't put rocks that close to the house, which then gives you a much better opportunity to play into the 4 foot, if indeed that's what you want to do. Big fan of the bump tick, and that, in my view, is how to play it. The third shot that I want to talk to you about in this episode is a draw to the back quadrant. Now, when would you draw to the back quadrant? Well, this is the scenario that most teams have difficulty with. When they come to me and want to talk to me about strategy, so often the situation that's causing the most concern is being up on the scoreboard and with last rock and relatively late in the game. They have got certainly a measure of control in winning the game. And what do we do? Well, of course, the opposition has put their, centerline guard. Now, of course, you can play that bump tick. But the last thing that I think you should play is to go around their centerline guard. Again, that's why they put it there. They want your rock into the 4-foot area. In fact, they need it there. They need protection from the front, which they've provided. And now if you draw around and they freeze up to you, now you've created the protection from a freeze perspective. The last thing that skip of the team without last rock wants you to do is draw to the back quadrant, because now you have last rock and it's something that they have to remember. It's there. You're in a scoring position. And now if they draw around, you are in the driver's seat. As far as I'm concerned, you can select either rotation, just nice back 12, hack weight, body of weight for my Scottish friends, and you can tick that, and then you roll to the side. Now you've got two rocks in counting position with last rock, and the team without last rock is really in a quandary as what they're going to do. So please consider, when you're up in the score and you have last rock advantage, or even if it's just plain last rock advantage, you don't have to be a lemming. You don't have to do what everybody else does. Drawing a rock to either of the back quadrants, I think, is a great way to play. The last shot about which I want to refer today, again, like guards, it's a shot that we play all the time, and I'm referring to the come around. But just like guards, there's two types of come arounds. The first type of come around is when you absolutely positively have to bury as much of the stone that's being delivered as possible. And in that scenario, you're going to have to play pretty close to the guard because you want to hide as much of the rock as possible. The second type of come around is one where you don't have to risk the ranch. What you really need to do is just get past the guard and then some good brushing to promote the curl, even if you don't bury the entire rock. But see, the point is, in that situation, you don't have to bury the entire rock. In fact, sometimes it's actually better if you don't bury the whole rock and you leave part of it showing to try to entice the other team and perhaps going after it. I differentiate these two types of come arounds as code red and code blue. So if we go back to the first type of come around where we absolutely positively have to bury it, and therefore we're going to have to run the risk of perhaps wrecking on the guard, well, the reward is worth the risk. And so it's a code red type of come around. And my teams had a signal so that the shooter and the brushers, everybody on the team knew that it was a code red. But so often we would realize that we don't have to risk wrecking on the shot, on the guard, I should say. Well, all we need to do is get past the guard, and then with some intelligent brushing, we bury the stone as much as possible. We don't have to bury the whole thing. And as I said, sometimes it's not really necessary to entice the other team to play a shot that's a little higher risk for them. And we called that code blue, and we had a signal for that. And I would suggest that your team, perhaps in a post game, re-examine your come around shots and put them into those categories. Was the come around that was called in the third end or whatever end you happen to be talking about, was it really a code red, or could we have played it as a code blue? Again, I don't think teams differentiate enough between the two types of come arounds. And again, code red, you risk the ranch and it's worth the risk. You might wreck on the guard, or a code blue. All we need to do is get past the guard. And of course, what we're talking about here is execution tolerance. And that was the same idea with what I talked about at the beginning with the two types of guards. Staying inside of execution tolerance is one of the first things that a team can do to improve its performance. Recognize the tolerance and make sure you stay inside the execution tolerance. Don't make unnecessary errors. And so often, it's those unnecessary errors that cause the L's instead of the W's. Very interested in your comments. My email address again, coachbill@hay.net. That's coachbill@hay.net. Be interested in how you feel about what I've said about the most misplayed shot in curling, the guard, the bump tick, which I don't think is used nearly enough, the draw to either of a back quadrant position, and the come arounds, code blue and code red. Before I sign off today here in Sydney, British Columbia, I want to recognize an individual that we lost about a week ago. He was an inventor, a creative thinker, and curler. His name, Lino Diorio. Some of you may have heard of his name, but we've all heard of, and perhaps used, many of his developments or inventions. His first involvement in the game from an equipment perspective was with sliders. As a curler, Lino was not very happy with the slider that he presently had on his shoe. And so he developed a slider that we've all come to know as the Balance Plus slider. And it was at that stage in the development of that product, which was extremely successful, that Lino, his wife Lynn, and his friend Scott Taylor, who now runs Balance Plus, formed the company. But in conjunction with the slider, Lino employed electronic timers to record the time from the back line to the first hog line, as well as rock speed after the hog line. This allowed a curler's sliding speed consistency to be measured and improved. And of course, I referred to that in a very recent episode on timing systems. Competitive teams were able to become accurate interval timers to aid in brushing and sweeping judgment and communication. In 1997, Balance Plus built a machine that can deliver up to 9 rocks at a time, each with identical speed and rotation. This machine, along with the computer software that he developed, enabled curlers to know the speeds of all the rocks relative to one another. And I have a story about that rock launcher. It was the very early years of Jim Waite's Trillium Curling Camp, one of the top curling camps in the world. And it was in the early years to the point that we were at the Peterborough Curling Club. Now, not the original Peterborough Curling Club, but the new Peterborough Curling Club, which took over a church of all places. The sanctuary of the church became the ice shed. Well, these curling clubs to which I speak, and there are many that are operating right now, Elaine Dag Jackson's 4-foot camp has been going for many years. In fact, I think Elaine's camp was probably the first one. But anyway, back to the Trillium camp. It was in August, and in southern Ontario, August meant the Triple H days, hot, hazy, humid, and the ice had just been installed, and that's an important point to remember here. The ice had just been installed at the Peterborough Curling Club for the Trillium camp. Well, I arrived a day early and met my friend Scott Taylor, who was out onto the ice, and he called me over and said, "Bill, you've got to come and see what Lino and I have put together." I could see that it was a rock launcher, and I'll try to describe it as best I can. It was an aluminum frame which had spaces for a set of rocks, and either 8 or 9, But the genius was that Lino could get the rocks rotating. Now what he had to figure out was how to move them down the ice. So along each of the sidelines was a track. And that frame that contained the rocks that were rotating either in a clockwise or counterclockwise direction were in their place. And Scott, had, with a remote control, Scott was able to move that frame and the rocks using the tracks on either side. So if you can visualize that, the track, as I recall, I'm going to guess, was maybe 5 meters or so in length, and it came to a stop. And then, of course, the rocks made their way down the ice, and you could see the relative speeds of each of them. Well, then, of course, to reset, the device had to move back into its original position. Now, remember I said that the ice had just been installed. It wasn't very thick, and when Scott pressed the button to bring the device back into position, it snapped the two rubber hacks right out of the ice. Scott turned to me and said, "Bill, we have now made the most expensive hack removal equipment ever known to mankind." I'll always remember that. So Lino was an original thinker. And we owe many of the inventions that we commonly use in our sport to him. So, Lino, rest in peace, my friend. You may be gone, but your presence will always be felt in our sport. I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that Balance Plus, the business Balance Plus, has been a great friend to my coaching manual and the Sandra Schmirler Foundation. It is Scott Taylor who put his hand up when I was first trying to market a Pain in the Glass, a Coach's Companion, all proceeds to the Schmirler Foundation. I found it was a little bit more difficult to market it than I thought it was going to be. I must admit I got a little bit to the frustration point. And Scott contacted me, said, "Bill, I will do the marketing. You can sell a Pain in the Glass, a Coach's Companion out of Balance Plus." Balance Plus doesn't make a cent from this. We charge $50 a copy, which covers shipping. The printer, Corporate Imaging Center in London, does all the printing free of charge. The only thing that's paid for is the material, the paper and the ink. So to those two companies and the people who run them, I want to say a hearty thank you on my behalf and, of course, for the Schmirler Foundation. So if you are interested in a copy of A Pain in the Glass, A Coach's Companion, you need to go to the Balance Plus website and you will be able to order a copy. So there you have our episode for today. I want to thank you very much for tuning in and listening to me kind of ramble on a bit here today about the curling shots, but I definitely wanted to talk about Lino DiOrio. So wherever you are, good curling, stay safe, and you know what I'm going to say, please think only those happy thoughts.